everybody. We'll call the meeting to order. And we've got the Department of Employment and Economic Development in front of us today. Commissioner McElroy, are you starting it off, or are you going to bring some folks up with you, or what?
Mr. Chairman, I will start off and do a brief overview and then bring up the people who really know something to provide more detail.
All righty. Well,
thank you. Mr. Chairman, for the record, my name is Dan McElroy, and I'm Commissioner in the Department of Employment and Economic Development. Our purpose today is to review our budget request for 2008 and 2009. We're going to start with the initiatives. Let me give you a broad overview here. The mission, I think, of the agency is well known to you, but our charge is to support the economic success of individuals, businesses, and communities by improving opportunities for growth. We do that through three main areas of the agency: our Business and Community Development Division, the Workforce Division, and our Unemployment Insurance Group. We do that by expending about $2.7 billion a biennium in resources. And that's divided, as is shown on this slide, $1.6 billion in unemployment insurance, of which about $1.5 billion is for benefits, and $100 million over a two-year period is for the operation of the system and the upgrading of our technology. About $370 million in other federal funds for programs like vocational rehabilitation, Workforce Investment Act programs, veteran service programs, programs for the blind, and others. That are funded out of specific federal appropriations from a variety of federal agencies. $560 million expended through the Public Facilities Authority in funds that come from state revolving loan funds, some federal funds, and bonded funds that assist communities in meeting wastewater, freshwater, and other infrastructure needs. $112 million in special revenue funds, including workforce development, petroleum tank release, and repayments from existing loan programs and some other miscellaneous state special revenue funds. And then $96 million from the state's general fund over a two-year period, which is an increase of 12%, or about $21 million, from our current appropriation. I'd like to briefly go through the kind of the pie charts that show where the money comes from and where it goes. We did this in two pie charts because unemployment insurance is such a large part of the agency that it somewhat skews the view of what we do as our Public Facility Authority funds. And the fund, or the pie chart on your, I believe it's on your left, it says all funds, shows the breakdown of funds including unemployment insurance and Public Facilities Authority. The view without the PFA and unemployment insurance is a little more accurate projection of how we use general state money. The expenditures for funds echo the description I gave based on the first slide. The general fund is a relatively small but extremely important part of the work that we do. The Department of Employment and Economic Development, which I'm going to refer to for simplicity as DEED, is very much a statewide agency. Much of our economic development work concentrates in greater Minnesota, where there are greater challenges. Unemployment insurance and workforce development are very much statewide programs. There are 48 workforce centers that are partnerships with county workforce investment boards, county governments, and a variety of other partners. The stars on this chart are small business development centers, which are principally located at colleges and universities and are partners with local entities and the Federal Small Business Administration. So DEED is very much a statewide organization. The change items that are governor's initiatives for this coming biennium are shown here, or shown on this and the following slide. They come in two categories. One is recommendations for one-time funding, and the one-time funding includes $10 million to recapitalize very important economic development programs. $7 million of that is for the Minnesota Investment Fund, which we use leveraged with many other sources of funds to help economic development transactions take place all across the state, often in greater Minnesota. $2 million for the Redevelopment Fund, which is used to clean up contaminated or polluted sites, and $1 million for the Urban Initiatives Loan Fund a revolving loan fund targeted at low-income areas of the state. $1 million of one-time money for the Biobusiness Alliance to continue their very important work in developing the biobusiness industry in Minnesota. $250,000 from the University Enterprise Laboratories located in St. Paul, but between the Minneapolis and St. Paul campuses, and serving as an incubator to promote the development of very high-tech, very exciting companies, often medical or other science-related industries. I know they also have a bill that will come before this committee and we'll hear more about as the session progresses. $200,000 for Positively Minnesota, which is our marketing effort to bring the news about Minnesota's economic investment opportunities across the country. And $192,000, it's kind of an unusual request, but state law requires that we reimburse the Unemployment Insurance Fund for unemployment obligations of entities which essentially go out of business. And this $192,000 represents obligations from charter schools, which have gone out of business in the last few years, and for the state ombudsman for corrections, which we abolished in state law, but they still have some unpaid unemployment. And this is a matter of state statute that requires us to bring this appropriation to your attention. There are also some initiatives in the governor's budget that are in the base. Those include $5 million to maximize federal resources for vocational rehabilitation and state services for the blind. The good news about this appropriation, there are several good news things about it. And you'll hear more about our work in voc rehab and state services for the blind in a few minutes. But this appropriation leverages $3.70 of federal money for every dollar of state money that we appropriate. And so it is very well leveraged money, and it helps us assist more people in getting into the workforce if they're eligible for vocational rehabilitation. And it helps improve both the employability and the quality of life of those who are visually handicapped, blind, or deaf-blind. We're also requesting $1.8 million for our extended employment programs. And this is a combination of $1 million for the regular extended employment that helps those who are developmentally delayed or physically handicapped, and $800,000 for the programs for the mentally ill for community-aided employment and helping these people to be productive. And as you will hear in a few minutes, the wages that people are able to earn in these categories are increasingly very competitive, particularly in some of the categories. We're also requesting $1 million for a new program called Career Guides for Youth, and it assists us in providing money to college and university students who are studying to be guidance counselors to place those people in Minnesota high schools to provide additional guidance counseling capacity. And so it helps college students, it helps high school students, and it helps guidance counselors function effectively. And we're very excited about the program, and we can answer questions about it when that's appropriate. There's also $871,000 as a compensation adjustment to provide the funds for salary negotiations coming up, and $200,000 for small community technical assistance through the Public Facilities Authority to assist very small communities, communities with a maximum, I think, of about 40 households to qualify or to work on programs regarding water quality, in some cases on the TDML issue of contaminated waters. That summarizes our budget requests, our initiatives. There are some pass-throughs in our base that you should know about, and certainly are things that you may want to give consideration to. None of these are recommended for changes in the governor's budget. These were in last biennium's budget, and we're recommending them for continuation. $300,000 for the Rural Policy and Development Center in St. Peter. $310,000 for, and there's a typo here. We didn't mean to change the name of the Metropolitan Economic Development Association to Commission, but it was just got typed that way. It's actually MEDA, M-E-D-A, Metropolitan Economic Development Association, and they do excellent work in a variety of communities and with a variety of programs. $300,000 for Women Venture, $120,000 for the Inventors Congress in Redwood Falls, $610,000 for Twin Cities Rise, a workforce training program for very challenging populations, $300,000 for Advocating Change Together, and $150,000 for Youth Bill. Those come from the General Fund. This list comes from the Workforce Development Fund. The principal goal of the Workforce Development Fund is to provide funding for dislocated workers and for job skills partnership programs. But with the recommendation of the administration at times, and certainly with the previous legislative action, we have funded some direct programs through the Workforce Development Fund. And in the base are $500,000 for LifeTrack resources, $1.75 million for our Opportunities Industrialization Centers, often called OICs, that work principally with American Indian population, $350,000 for deaf and hard of hearing services, $13.8 million is the base, it's about 50% of the base funding for extended employment, which I mentioned earlier, and $2.5 million for Minneapolis' summer youth program. So those are the pass-through funding that are included from the Workforce Development Fund. With that, Mr. Chairman and members, I'd like to begin bringing up members of our leadership team who are with me today to work their way through the budget. And we're going to go as quickly as we can and leave as much time for questions as possible. The first to come up is Mark Loftus with our Business and Community Development team, and he will work through that section of the budget books with you. Mr. Loftus.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Mark Loftus. I'm Director of Business Development within Business and Community Development, which I'll refer to shorthand today as BCD. Our part of the budget narrative begins on page 9 in your budget books. And I'm going to, if I can first go through the sections of the operating divisions and then come back to the change requests. On page 10 is a summary of all the funds allocated to our division. You'll see about 69 full-time equivalent positions in there. And the change requests of about $11.4 million are at the, near the top of that page, and I'll come back to those. As I talk about the whole division, I would like you to know a couple of things. One is that geographically, as we break down all the expenditures of funds, in 2006, about 58% of our funds were spent in greater Minnesota. And I also should tell you that we track all these programmatic expenditures by a number of identifiers, like city, county, region, legislative district. So if you have an interest in any particular part of the state and where our funds have gone, we can provide those reports to you as you might wish. If you turn to page 11, it begins a narrative on the first of our three parts of our division. This covers the Business Development Office, in which we assist businesses of all sizes, from small entrepreneurs to larger companies, helping them to grow and start and hopefully thrive in Minnesota. We have staff who package resources for expansion. We have the program that helps with the Small Business Innovation Research Program, helping companies commercialize technology with federal monies. We support the Positive Minnesota marketing effort. And we're also the home for the state staff support for the biosciences. Among the other parts of this Business Development Office, though, are Small Business Development Centers, which we operate through 19 locations around the state, helping over 3,600 entrepreneurs each year with free counseling and advice. And we produce the Guide to Starting a Business, a book many of you, I'm sure, have seen. It's in its current, it's at the printer today as we speak. And we also produce other publications, but to help provide assistance to entrepreneurs. On page 14 of our budget book, you see the business development budget, which largely consists of support for the 24 staff positions. It includes federal funds and state match for small business development centers. It has a revolving account that we use for our marketing programs where organizations contribute funds and then we work with them to just expend those funds. And also the pass-through grants that the commissioner mentioned from EDA, Women Venture, and the Inventors Congress. On page 17, we'll skip those change requests for the time being, but on page 17 is the second major function of the division, which is business and community finance. This is, as the commissioner mentioned, where the bulk of our division's money goes into things like the Minnesota Investment Fund and Business Assistance and also the Urban Initiative Program, which helps small business lending in the metro area. But largely, the financial resources are expended in community infrastructure programs, by which we mean a lot of different things. We're talking about water systems, wastewater treatment, quality housing and commercial rehabilitation, cleanup of contaminated land, clearing of dilapidated buildings for new development, and public infrastructure, all of which is, of course, around the whole concept of having safe, affordable, usable public infrastructure so that more private investment can occur. Programmatically, these funds are expended in things like the contamination cleanup program, Redevelopment Grant Program and Small Cities Development Program. On page 18 of the book is a summary of the Public Facilities Authority programs, which, as the Commissioner said, over $560 million in biennium expended on a variety of programs. Terry Coleman, I believe, is here today to talk about or answer specific questions you might have about that, but a great deal of impact across the state, metro and greater Minnesota. And finally, the third part of our division begins on page 27, Minnesota Trade Office. As we all know, international trade is an increasingly important aspect of our economy, and those companies that export tend to have, studies have shown, tend to be more profitable, have a wider base of financial income and profitability, and our trade office helps those companies with access to market information, helping identify ways to navigate through the exporting process. So we do seminars, we help put on trade missions and trade shows, and also we are increasingly getting into opportunities for foreign direct investment, where companies like Suzlon, which is the wind turbine blade manufacturer that opened up a plant in Pipestone, represents foreign direct investment. We need to have more of that interaction both ways on investment related to trade. So that's a very quick overview of our whole BCD. Now, if I can go back, Mr. Chairman, to the change requests, which the Commissioners also discussed. Beginning on page 15 is the first of those, the BioBusiness Alliance. They are working on their assessment of the biosciences industry and also establishing a bioresource network to help companies. There's currently about 20 businesses on their list that are staffed, and they are working with companies that are looking to expand or locate in Minnesota. There's a $1 million request there, a one-time request. On page 16 is the request for $250,000 for University Enterprise Laboratories, or UEL as it's known, which is on the west edge of St. Paul near University and 280. To help supplement their income from fledgling enterprises that are located there. On page 22 is another one-time change request for the contamination cleanup program. This asks for dedication of the contamination tax rather than to go to the general fund, to dedicate it to the contamination cleanup grant program. Currently, that program is assisted or has resources from several places like the general fund, $1.4 million, the Petro Tank Fund for $26.2 million, and Remediation Fund for $700,000 a year. And we're asking for that fund to receive all the contamination tax for its purposes. Projects in around the state, such as the Globe Materials and Griffin Wheel Project in St. Paul, some projects along Highway 53, Mr. Chairman, in Virginia, assisted by this program. Dispatch laundry site in Minneapolis and Whittier neighborhood is another example of a contamination program as well. So. On page 23 is our request for $7 million from the Minnesota Investment Fund to help provide incentives to help companies grow here. Currently, we are living off the loan repayments from past loans in the state portion of our program. And that totals about $1.2 million per year, and this would help significantly capitalize that program. One of the projects we have done in the past, again in your area, Mr. Chairman, Blue Cross, Blue Shield of Virginia, and Aurora. On page 24 is a request for $2 million for the redevelopment program, which in other legislation is proposed to be able to be statewide in its impact and is used to help remove blighted properties and bring them back on the tax rolls. So $2 million request there one time. On page 25 is a request for $200,000 for the biennium to help very small towns evaluate their failing septic systems, which is an important health and safety issue, obviously, and will help those cities that otherwise would not have the financial resources to do that investigation.
Mr. Chairman, in the handout that accompanied that was the PowerPoint slides, there's a list of the communities that we expect to qualify. And as I indicated, these are very small communities.
And, Mr. Chairman, on page 26 is the final one-time change request for the Urban Initiative Program, asking for $1 million infusion into that program, which was last capitalized with $6 million in the mid-90s. It has since made $11 million in loans, so that money's turned over several different times. It works through 10 neighborhood and local partners in the Twin Cities, primarily Minneapolis and St. Paul, but there are some suburbs that also qualify, inner-ring suburbs. And there have been many projects in Minneapolis and St. Paul over the years area, including in Minneapolis, Representative Clark, to the La Loma Tamales project. 40 jobs there in the vicinity of 30th and Cedar that has a community kitchen, manufacturing of food products and related businesses with that. So, as I said, we do have a list of all, believe it or not, back in 1990, of all the projects we've done in all of these programs, to the extent that they've existed that long. So if you'd like information on those, we can provide them. So that's the end of my summary, Mr. Chairman.
I will bring up Rick Caligiuri to start on workforce development. Mr. Chairman, do you want to take questions now?
The committee, well, I guess we'll take questions now as the individuals come up. Representative Hartman first.
Well, I'm happy to wait if you want to walk through the whole thing and then go back and do questions.
Maybe it's easier this way. Well, go ahead.
On page 18 of the business and community finance outline, it talks about the water pollution control revolving fund and drinking water and wastewater and TMDL grant programs. I'm wondering why these are administered through DEED and not through PCA. And then same question with regard to the transportation revolving loan fund. Why is that not administered through MnDOT?
Let me ask Terry Coleman, who runs that. The short answer is that those agencies are heavily involved in the technical aspects of deciding which communities qualify, how the projects are engineered. But at the finance end, it is almost a bank-like endeavor. And so managing the trust indentures, the revolving loan fund of federal funds, and the bond funds that we get from the state, the partners decided quite some time ago that they were comfortable with what had been the Department of Trade and Economic Development, now DEED, managing the finances, where the Pollution Control Agency and the Department of Health and the Department of Transportation are heavily involved in the programmatic area.
Mr. Chair, Representative. Another quick answer to the question. The Public Facilities Authority is an interagency agency consisting of six different state agencies. We're housed in DEED, and I think because we're housed in DEED and we're not housed in a regulatory agency, I think people are a lot more willing to come in and talk to us. A lot of cities, a lot of communities want to make sure funds are available and they can provide the solution if they know they got problems before the regulatory agencies do. So we are a multi-agency. All those agencies are represented. And Commissioner McElroy is correct. We serve more as the banker role. All the agencies set priorities. They all review and the plans and specifications, make sure the project meets whatever standards they've chosen. They leave the financing up to us. We're also housed in the Business Community Development Division. That was done back in 1987 intentionally so we could work closely with Small Cities Community Development Block Grant Program, which was getting about $25 million a year in federal grants, which was a pretty good chunk of money that we could supplement state funding at the time to get these high-cost projects done. So I hope that answers your question somewhat.
But.
Okay. Representative Severson had a question, but he's gone, so why don't we just continue,
right.
Commissioner?
Rick Caligiuri is going to come up, and we'll start on the section of the budget book that talks about workforce development. And Rick is responsible for adult programs, and we'll have several of our people coming up and back. So Rick, if you'd introduce yourself for the record and tell them where you're starting in the book.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Rick Caligiuri. I'm in charge of all job seeker services, and that would include all of the employment training services for both adults and youth. And I will begin and go over the programs that, if you're following along on your budget books, are on pages 33 through 40, which would include both the adult services and business services. The Workforce Development Division within DEED is a very large division, and the mission of the Workforce Development Division is to improve Minnesota's global competitiveness by providing career information and employment and training services to businesses and workers. There are several major subdivisions within workforce development, and again, I will be going over, at this point, the adult services and business services. I'll be back later for youth services, and then there are some other branches that will be covered as well. But going to page 33 in your books, I'll start out with the adult services, and that would include the dislocated worker program, which is a very high-profile program that comes into play for individuals who have been laid off through no fault of their own, and in particular, those very high-profile mass layoffs like you know, the Ford Motor Company, Ainsworth, Anderson Windows, and many others. This program has both a federal and state component to it, and basically in the last couple of years we've served about 20,000 Minnesotans each year in that program. We also have the Workforce Investment Act programs, which includes the what is called the Title I-B adult program. It's a general employment and training program for adult job seekers. The Job Seeker Services Program, formerly called Job Service, we operate, we have staff in all of the workforce centers across the state that help Minnesotans in looking for jobs, and we have a wide array of services available in those workforce centers, some light counseling and referral services, and basically, you know, employment training programs, screening for eligibility for the numerous programs that we have. We also have veterans programs, which in addition to the job seeker programs, it does provide the general job seeking assistance to veterans, but then there's also some specialized services involved for veterans that include case management and transition assistance and reintegration programs, working very closely, of course, with our Reserve and National Guard. As you well know, that we're expecting nearly 5,000 returnees coming back in August and September, and these veteran staff are centrally involved in that effort with their employment and training needs. We have a federal program called the Senior Community Service Employment Program, which works with older workers and provides basically part-time employment and other services for older workers. We have several local providers as well as a couple of national sponsors in Minnesota that are involved in that program. We have the Opportunities Industrialization Centers. There are five of these centers located throughout the state, and they provide specialized, very intense services to minority and other very economically disadvantaged populations throughout the state. That is a pass-through appropriation. We also have a family of programs that we work with the Department of Human Service. Very closely we partner with them, and the Department of Human Services is definitely the lead on these programs, but DEED has a very strong component, and that is working with individuals who are on Minnesota's Family Investment Program or Food Support Employment Training, as well as the Diversionary Work Program. And again, these are people who are on public assistance, and we work with them to provide employment and training resources and help them find jobs. We also have the Displaced Homemaker Program. There are six independent providers of these services located throughout the state. And again, this is another pass-through program. And with that, I will move directly to the business service program, that component. And that would include our business service field operations. We have business service specialists located throughout the state.
That's on page 38 of your books.
And those individuals basically are in contact, direct contact with Minnesota businesses, and trying to solve their employment and workforce needs throughout the state. I believe that in the past calendar year, those individuals were in contact with about 5,000 businesses throughout the state, again trying to help businesses with their worker retention needs, as well as filling job openings and other workforce needs. We have four industry specialists that help us strategically look at various industry and sectoral approaches in workforce development. And we also have the Minnesota Job Bank, which is the primary electronic tool for labor exchange in the state of Minnesota. It's the largest employment database in Minnesota. It's widely used by both job seekers and businesses. And I believe last year, for example, we had about 165,000 to 170,000 job seekers utilize that electronic job bank. We have a program called the Foreign Labor Certification Program, which is basically a part of the process for businesses to hire foreign workers. We're involved in only part of that process, and that is there's a certain number of things that employers would have to do before they can hire foreign workers. In other words, they have to do a job search to see if there are any American workers to fill the jobs. And there are some prevailing wage issues, and again, it's a part of the process that DEED works with employers. The rest of the process is strictly handled. H-1B applications, for example, are strictly handled by the Federal Department of Labor. We also have the Work Opportunity Tax Credit, which is a federal program that provides an incentive to businesses and employers through a tax credit to hire certain target groups of individuals. They're all primarily economically disadvantaged target groups, and they would include individuals with disabilities, economically disadvantaged youth, ex-felons, veterans, people on public assistance, etc. At this point, that concludes the Adult and Business Services. I'd be happy to answer any questions you may have.
Representative Clark.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just wanted to check, Mr. O'Gary, when you were talking about the Foreign Labor Certification Program, the kind of screening that's done to see if there are any U.S. Workers available for the jobs. Are these just for businesses that are in the U.S.?
Yes.
And just in Minnesota?
Yes.
Okay. And what is that screening? Can you give me a brief idea of what that screening is?
Again, it involves both the H-1B visas and H-2B visas. The state has a part, plays a part in that whole process.
Okay.
The federal government handles most of it, but a business, for example, before they're going to hire foreign workers, they have to go through some kind of a process. Mm-hmm. Place job orders in the job bank and several other things relative to trying to find American workers that would fill those jobs.
Okay. And then, can I put Mr. Chen on a different area? Did you mention the diversionary work program, or did I just miss it?
I did mention that.
You did. And the department's role in that is, that, I mean, this is a requirement through MFIP, right?
Correct.
And the department's role in this, I'm confused exactly what it is. Does it have anything to do with the quality of the job at all? Or?
No, we provide overall coordination for that program. That program, as well as MFIP, is contracted out at on the county basis. And in some cases, we have central staff, indeed, that provide administrative and training for those staff out in the field in the county on the employment component.
Just one other question. Do you have an average wage for those jobs provide?
Mr. Chair, Representative, I do not have an average wage. I could get that information.
I appreciate that.
We'll try to find that, Representative Clark,
thank
and
you.
Probably will come from the Department of Human Services.
Okay.
Representative Mahoney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Clark's line of questioning brought to mind something here. On the foreign workers and the visas, do we have many of those visas for the state of Minnesota? I mean, are there many foreign workers with those visas in the state of Minnesota?
Mr. Chair, Representative, off the top of my head, I believe that we process a little over 1,000, and most of them are temporary jobs, and I think most of them are in the agricultural area.
Chairman Mahoney, the visa program that gets talked about for high-tech workers no longer has a state component. that is strictly handled by the federal government and by the U.S. Department of Labor. So that number, if there are engineers or biologists or chemists that have H-1s and H-1B visas, that's not something that there's any longer a state role in. There was up until a few years ago.
Mr. Chair. Mm-hmm. How would I go about finding out that particular number of the high-tech visas for the state? Because, and here's my reasoning, I followed, you know, the jobs in the state of Minnesota for my career at the Capitol, and the last reports that I've been seeing is that we've been losing information technology jobs. We're not creating as many as we had anticipated. We have a slowdown in that particular employment, and I'm just wondering if we have people here from other countries on that particular type visa. So what I would like to find out, if we're issuing them, and if we are, or we wouldn't be, but the federal government, the state of Minnesota, I'd like to find out why we would be issuing them. If, you know, if we're having a slowdown in the state, there's obviously people out there looking for these type jobs. So if you could help me out with that, I would really appreciate it.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Mahoney, we can inquire of the U.S. Department of Labor on your behalf.
That would be good. And then I'm sure Mr. Calagione would swing by my office or give me a call. It's pretty informal in my little corner of the world up there.
We will try to do that. There's also a regional office of the U.S. Department of Labor in Chicago. A former Minnesotan named Byron Zeidema, who gets here from time to time. It may be that you and Mr. Zeidema should have a conversation along those very lines, and you could help us influence his thinking. All right. Mr. Chairman, I'll take a couple of pages here and just explain programs starting on page 41. One portion of the Department of Employment and Economic Development is disability determination, which we do on behalf of the federal government. We have about 160 people that work in this area. They're in the Metro Square building in downtown St. Paul. And determine availability for federal disability insurance and disability supplemental disability income, and do it in award-winning fashion, and have reduced their backlog. We're quite proud of the work that they do. With that, I think I will bring Kim Peck up, who works in vocational rehabilitation. Are you going to take extended employment?
Yes.
All right. If you would start there, that would be great. I know enough to be dangerous, but not enough to be terribly informative.
Good afternoon. Thank you, Commissioner McElroy. For the record, my name is Kimberly Peck. I'm the Director of Rehabilitation Services. I will be starting on page 43 of your budget book. Before I launch into the particulars about the extended employment program, I want to just provide an explanation about how our work in rehabilitation services fits with a larger mission of DEED. Our mission of rehabilitation services, and you may find me using the acronym RS for rehabilitation services. Our mission is to empower Minnesotans with disabilities to achieve their goals for employment, independent living, and community integration. Our mission is critical to DEED's objective to support the economic success of individuals and businesses and communities, because it's common knowledge that there is a significant labor shortage looming. Actually, at the State Rehab Council meeting this morning, I heard that labor shortage referred to as the gray tsunami. I thought that was quite apt. And the reality is many employers are already experiencing difficulty in finding the resources they need to fill their jobs. And the fact in Minnesota is that approximately 12% of the working age population are individuals with disabilities. And it's important to understand that the employment rate for persons with disabilities in Minnesota is significantly less than for individuals without disabilities. Particularly, the employment rate for working-age Minnesotans with disabilities is only 44.9% as compared to 83.5% for working-age Minnesotans without disabilities. The fact is that individuals with disabilities have marketable skills, they want to work, but we have to break down the barriers in employment settings to open up more opportunities for them to be employed. And that's where the extended employment program, that's where the VR program comes in. In rehab services, RS, again, there are three distinct programs: extended employment, independent living, and VR. I turn your attention to page 43. We'll start out talking about the Extended Employment Program. The Extended Employment Program, the acronym for that is EE. Of course, in government, we have to have acronyms. That Extended Employment Program is funded exclusively by state funds to provide ongoing supports for individuals whose disability is such that in order for them to secure and maintain employment, they need ongoing supports. Now, I think this program, I know for a fact that this program is quite unique in the country. There aren't many states at all that have a program like Minnesota's Extended Employment Program. And I think it's to the credit of Minnesota that because of that, we are in the top five states of the employment rate for persons with disabilities. So, again, it's to your credit, it's to our credit. I think that at Rehab Services in the Extended Employment Program that we had the wherewithal to recognize that individuals with significant disabilities, some individuals need ongoing supports, and we have responsibility to provide that. The budget initiative that you see related to the Extended Employment Program, there's really two parts to it because there are two parts to the Extended Employment Program. There's the basic program, which cuts across all disability groups, and what that does is provide support or resources to about 30 vendors within Minnesota to provide the ongoing supports for individuals so they can retain their employment. And what I like to make note of is that the Extended Employment Basic Program reimburses vendors on an outcome basis. We reimburse only for hours of work as compared to services provided. I think we did a great job this last fiscal year. There were almost 5 million hours worked in state fiscal year 06, and wages earned by individuals with significant disabilities in the Extended Employment Basic Program was up to $27.6 million. The legislature in 2005 passed, provided a one-time appropriation of $500,000 for each year of the biennium from the Workforce Development Fund. The budget initiative that you see on page 46 is to make that one-time appropriation permanent and to have it coming from the general fund. Again, it's important to consider that those resources go directly to providing individuals the ongoing support that they need, and so this amount of money would translate to providing ongoing support for about 350 people who, were it not for that support, likely would not be able to continue to be employed. On page 47, you see the budget initiative for the Extended Employment Program for persons with serious mental illness. There are 26 projects in Minnesota that provide support via the EESMI, another acronym, program. This program is a little bit different in terms of how it operates from the EE Basic Program in that it provides reimbursement to vendors by unit of service. And the reason for that is in the EESMI program, we provide services support for not only the ongoing support but placement services. Given the remitting nature of mental illness, it's not at all unusual that individuals will require placement services, and so we have the flexibility in this program to provide those services, also to provide support before an individual encounters difficulty that could put his or her job in jeopardy. The average wage of individuals in this program in state fiscal year 06 was $8.82, and the total wages earned in that state fiscal year were $1.8 million. This budget initiative, like for EE Basic, is to transfer the one-time appropriation from 2005 to the base and coming from the general fund. Any questions about extended employment, either the EE Basic or EESMI, before I move on to independent living?
Representative Reiner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I may need some help phrasing this question because I'm not sure. First of all, I'm wondering about the list of vendors, the 30 vendors you mentioned. Could that be made available to us?
Absolutely.
Okay, but then now my question is about the performance. You talked the performance component. You said the pay is simply for hours worked.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, some workers work on site in large groups, and other workers are taken to sites individually or have individual employment outside. Okay, so do you differentiate between costs incurred and the differences between that type of employment?
Mr. Chair, Representative, yes, in the basic program, that is absolutely correct. There are three levels of employment, starting at the, and forgive the language that I'm using, but starting at the lowest or the bottom level is the center-based employment, which probably is best known and understood as what we historically have called sheltered workshop. And I believe the reimbursement rate, oh, and I should have written these down, in terms of a reimbursement for our work is roughly $1.50, roughly, per hour of work. Then the next level up in terms of employment is community-based employment, and oftentimes it's the employment that you describe that occurs out in the community but in a setting of a group, either a crew or an enclave is the terminology that we use. An example.
It may include transportation to the job site. It may include a job coach on site. It's a heavier level of support.
Right. And the reimbursement for to the vendor for community employment is a little bit over $2 an hour. And I will get these exact or these precise numbers for you. At the top is the supported employment, which is employment that is typically a single site. The individual kind of owns the job. There is a crew of people there. And the reimbursement rate for the supported employment is about $3.15 per hour. So we really build in an incentive for these vendors to move individuals into a, again, forgive the language, a higher level of employment. We have individuals, but we have built into the funding mechanism a wage incentive that as employees are paid a higher wage, then we actually incent the vendor for providing the support for individuals to be successful in those high-paying jobs.
The vendors in this program are part of an association called MACRO, the Minnesota Association of Community Rehabilitation Organizations, and we'll be happy to provide you with a list. And they also have a website that's quite instructive.
Ms. Peck, can I ask you some, and I don't know, Commissioner McElroy, maybe I misunderstood. When you started off, you were talking about the Disability Determination Division, and you said the 160 employees, or it says 160 some FTEs here. Are they all located in St. Paul?
I believe so. Let me double check that. Yes, they are. And they're all in Metro Square.
And you have 50,000 Minnesota residents who file annually for disability benefits. Are those all in the metro area?
No, sir. They're not. No, Mr. Chairman, they're not.
So, Commissioner, you don't have any of these people located? How does the process work when one of my constituents files for Social Security disability?
So you go to their local Social Security office, and that portion of it is local. And the federal Social Security offices are staffed by federal employees. And for reasons of history, the federal government has always delegated, and delegates in all of the 50 states, the determination work to state agencies, traditionally workforce agencies and agencies that have relationships with the Department of Labor. And so the determination is done now principally electronically. The paperwork comes from the local Social Security office where interviews may be done. Doctor's records are requested electronically. And so from your constituents' point of view, they can go to a local Social Security office. And of the backroom work where people are trained to understand medical terminology, understand electronic medical records, and work with the verification of these conditions are done centrally. And part of that is because of the budget established by the federal government. This is paid for by the Social Security Administration. Has it be a fairly automated process today?
Well, Commissioner, is there, it always historically been that all these jobs have been centrally located? It would seem to me that, you know, that a lot of people that file for Social Security disability don't have the wherewithal of computer skills or even doctors for that matter. I'm not, you know, I'm kind of concerned that why aren't some of these employees located in geographic parts of the state?
The people with whom your constituents interact are in Social Security offices, and I can't tell you how many there are around the state, but I can find that out for you.
There's one in Hibbing, I know, in northern Minnesota that just downsized, so I don't know.
That is a federal issue, and the federal Social Security Administration.
That's a federal issue, but you know these folks are helping Minnesotans.
And, Mr. Chairman, that portion of the operation has traditionally been in St. Paul, and it is an area that requires today a fairly high level of automation. We have a significant investment in the computer systems that support it. I don't believe we have any plan to split that into multiple locations. That is discussed from time to time for other parts of state government. And as I indicated, other parts of the, about half of our employees are in greater Minnesota. Approximately. We have 1,450 full-time equivalents, about 700 and some are in St. Paul, and the balance are in the workforce centers. And so in other parts of the...
Commissioner, that doesn't necessarily mean half of them are in greater
Minnesota. They're outside of downtown St.
Paul.
That's correct.
Well, I'm just, you know, thinking off the top of my head here, Commissioner, because I know you helped downsize a lot of things in my district, so maybe I'm just, and move a little, few jobs out, so, you know. Now it could be my turn to move a few jobs into rural Minnesota that you helped move out of rural Minnesota in your capacity as chair of this committee and as finance commissioner and a few other things that I can recall that you did when we were battling here at the Capitol and when you were working for the governor, which you still are. But anyhow, I'm just curious as to why they're all located in St. Paul when we all have constituents who are Social Security disability.
I understand your concerns.
I'm sorry. Go ahead.
All right.
Any other questions?
Thank you, Commissioner McElroy. I will just briefly touch on independent living. That is the second of the three parts of rehabilitation services. You'll see the program narrative on page 48. The independent living program assists persons with disabilities to remain independent or to increase their independence in their homes and communities. Examples of the independent living services would include providing funds for an individual to have a ramp built onto their home so they can get out of their home and get to and from work. Another example would be the independent living skills training, so an individual can use Metro Mobility, that transit system, in order to get to and from work. Another significant service that the independent living centers have been focusing on of late are providing assistance to individuals under 65 who, because of their disability, were placed in a nursing home, providing the supports for those individuals to develop the independent living skills that they need so they can be living in an independent, you know, home-based or community-based setting rather than in an institution or a nursing home. There are four core services that you see noted in your program summary. The services for the independent living program are provided through a network of 8 not-for-profit, non-residential centers for independent living that cover the state. We've got the metro area, we've got Hibbing, Mankato, St. Cloud, Fargo, Marshall, East Grand Forks, Rochester. And also those services provided by the centers are supplemented by 17 voc rehab counselors who also carry an independent living caseload, and we provide case services dollars to those counselors to make available to individuals who, because of the limited availability of services from the centers, we try to support access to those services to the VR network. The funding that's being proposed, there's actually federal funding that comes to support the Centers for Independent Living and the independent living services provided by VR. The budget request that you see here is to maintain the current level of state funding at $1.69 million for you.
Representative Guthrie.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ms. Peck, I heard there was a change in the funding level for SILS. Could you explain how that happened and what I know there's a bill to try to return that.
Right.
Mr. Chair, Representative Gunther, this goes back in terms of that 10% that you and I talked about last week or so. It goes back to 2003 when the line item for state funding for the Centers for Independent Living was eliminated, essentially. It was at the point in time where every department was directed to find a 10% reduction in its general fund appropriation, and the decision was made to eliminate the state funds that were appropriated to the Independent Living Center. Fortunately, through the advocacy of the centers, the disability community group, the support from Representative Gunther and others, they were able to restore their funding to about 80% of the 2003 level. Currently, it's at 90%, 1.69. And I understand that MASL has introduced legislation, or will be introducing legislation, to restore their funding level to the 2003 level.
And MASL is the acronym for a trade association, the Minnesota Association for Centers for Independent Living.
Representative Gunther, I think a couple of bills, I don't know if that's my bill you're referring to, but I think it is. To restore it, I also have another bill that we're trying to clear up because the Centers for Independent Living are caught in a bureaucratic mess somewhat with, I think, the Department of Human Services on whether they can serve certain clients. I'm sure Ms. Peck knows the issue better than I, but I think that's putting some stress on them right now, too, in that they have to then, where they could serve these people directly, I think they have to go through counties or some other certain things, and I'm trying to clear that up. But, you know, I think you recall the one gentleman that was here one day when we had testimony from people that were working with these programs who was a veteran. Do you recall that, members? Who got referred from Veteran Services to a Center for Independent Living. Something's wrong, Representative Favorson and Haas. I hope that's in your bill. Maybe to correct that type of thing where something's wrong in this country and state where we're referring, where Veterans Affairs has to refer the veterans to Centers for Independent Living to get help. You know, but that's a whole other issue, and that's one thing I can't blame on you, Commissioner. Yes.
Yes.
But there are some things.
Yeah.
Mr. Chairman.
No, Henry.
All right.
Representative Gunther, did you have another question?
I just wanted to reply to your statement with the veterans. Some organizations, like SILS, are probably better than some organizations and the veterans, and they certainly have the charge to help all Minnesotans. And I maintain that SILS doesn't cost state government any money. It pays state government money because the alternative is institutionalization, and that's a lot higher than what we're paying for now.
Representative Gunther, I think everyone at this table wholeheartedly agrees with you. My concern was that Veterans Affairs preferred this gentleman to the SILS program, which has been cut by us on the state level, and you know, that was my concern. Not that anything to do with the SILS. I think they do an excellent job too. Excuse me for that. Mr. Hamilton, welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Chuck Hamilton, and I am the Director of State Services for the Blind. Our acronym is SSB. State Services for the Blind serves blind, visually impaired, and deafblind persons across Minnesota. In our communication center that you will learn about more in a few minutes, we also serve physically handicapped and other print handicapped persons, such as persons with dyslexia. We have served Minnesotans since 1923 for many years, as part of the Welfare and Human Services system, and since 1985, as part of the Economic Security and the Workforce Center Services system. We are located across the state in 13 workforce centers and at our office in the Midway District of St. Paul. State Services for the Blind has four major areas of service. First, we work with persons who are aimed at employment. There are a variety of services, including vocational assessment and counseling, training, placement, job accommodation. But what makes SSB different is that we have to focus on adjustment to blindness skills, assistive technology, and attitude. If customers don't learn Braille, cane travel, how to use assistive technology, and other blindness skills, they will not be able to take advantage of other educational and employment opportunities. These are very expensive but necessary services. Second, we serve customers who are primarily interested in living independently in their home, in their community, but not going to work. These customers are primarily seniors over the age of 55. This is the largest customer segment we serve. The occurrence of blindness and visual impairment increases with age, with a significant upward swing after the age of 60. almost everyone in this room has had or will have a family member or friend with macular degeneration, the leading cause of blindness for this group. Third, we focus on individualized assistive technology, technology that both workers and non-workers need to access the printed word. These are the screen readers, the talking computers, the software programs that enlarge things on computers and that type of thing. Also a very expensive but necessary service. And finally, through our communication center, State Services for the Blind provides public library types of service, making InkPrint accessible to Minnesota residents. The communication center may well be the best known of our services. It makes InkPrint accessible in a variety of ways. First, we actually operate a radio station called the Radio Talking Book Network. The Radio Talking Book reads newspapers and current bestsellers. Our partners at Minnesota Public Radio help us deliver the service across Minnesota. We also have a partnership with the Minnesota Library for the Blind and Physically Handicapped to make available books that have been recorded nationally by the Library of Congress. We also tape and in the future will digitize college textbooks for eligible students. We transcribe K-12 textbooks into Braille as a result of an agreement with the Department of Education. We also Braille for anyone else. We also had included in your packet the Manila piece, which is Midwestern United States, and this is something that's used roughly in about the third grade. We operate and sponsor two telephone-based newspaper reading services, Dial-In News for local papers and NFB Newsline for national papers and newspapers from other states. The Communication Center was started in 1953 with a grant from the Ham family, a well-known name here in Minnesota. The project continues as a model public-private partnership with a very active fundraising element. The Communication Center utilizes over 670 qualified volunteers who primarily develop the content for Communication Center services. Their outstanding service translates into a $1.7 million gift to Minnesota each year. The governor has requested the legislature to increase our general fund-based budget by $1 million each year. $900,000 would be put directly into the Communication Center, replacing $900,000 federal dollars that would be removed and transferred to State Services for the Blind's Workforce Development Unit. As I've already mentioned, the services our customers need to go to work are expensive, and they continue to rise, in that we have projected insufficient funds this fiscal year, to meet all our needs for customers going to work. This transfer would keep us from cutting services to job seekers or make cuts in the Communication Center. These federal dollars have always been primarily intended to be used directly in working with consumers going to work. In fact, our federal partner has made quite clear to us. The additional $100,000 is necessary to continue to match all the federal dollars we receive. With that, Mr. Chairman, I would end my presentation there.
Questions, Mr. Hamilton? Okay.
Representative Clark. I do have a question. Mr. Hamilton, that transfer of money is interesting, and I'd like to hear a little more about it, not right this minute, but I did want to ask you does the State Services for the Blind do anything to have a prevention program, blindness prevention program, and thinking of issues like macular degeneration and some of the things that we know might be helpful?
Madam Chair, Representative Clark, we don't have something that I would identify specifically as a prevention program. However, we have a very close relationship with all the optometrists and ophthalmologists across the state. And there is a statute that requires referrals and those kinds of things. We also have ophthalmological consultants that help us analyze medical conditions that our customers are going through.
Questions? Any other questions, Mr. Hamilton? Okay, go on.
Mr. Chairman, we'll bring Ms. Peck back, and she's going to talk about the balance of the programs in her division, principally vocational rehabilitation.
Hello again. The VR program, that's the acronym for the Vocational Rehabilitation Program, is essentially an employment and training program for persons with severe disabilities. It was started...
Page 54.
Yes.
Excuse me.
Page 54. Thank you. It was started in 1920, actually, to assist World War I veterans who were disabled in their service to the country to get back to an employment. And obviously the program has changed significantly since that time, but I would say that I absolutely expect that the VR program will be called upon to provide assistance to what's estimated to be 10% returning veterans from Iraq that will have traumatic brain injury. So we are gearing up to respond to that need. VR, the Vocational Rehabilitation Program, as distinct from the Extended Employment Program, provides time-limited services directly through professional staff as well as the purchase of services from community providers. These services include assessment, vocational evaluation, rehabilitation counseling, training and education, assistive technology, and job placement. In federal fiscal year 06, we served over 20,000 people, and in federal fiscal year 06, those 20,000 people, let me say, were across the whole range of the service delivery system from application to successful closure based on employment. In federal fiscal year 06, over 2,500 people achieved their employment goal and were earning an average wage of $10.79. That's individuals working without support. The average length of involvement of an individual with the VR program is between 30 and 34 months. Now, with your permission, I'd like to just very quickly share a success story. In anticipation of this afternoon's testimony, I put the call out to the field, and Representative Rukavina, just so you know, we have VR staff throughout Minnesota.
I was going to ask that question.
Yes, we have approximately 30 people in the St. Paul office, in the administrative office, another small percentage in the metro area, and the rest are in greater Minnesota. I can remember it was this last year I had the opportunity to visit all of the field offices, and that drive to Crookston, that's a long one, but it's good to get out there.
It's the same distance for Representative Leader.
The success story that I want to share with you is an individual that we have been working with recently who took a vacation to Mexico and unfortunately due to a swimming accident in a matter of seconds became quadriplegic. This individual was, prior to leaving on vacation, was in a high-level management position in a social service agency in the metro area. He contacted rehab services from his acute hospitalization at Abbott Northwestern and initiated contact there in terms of, my life has been changed dramatically. I want to get back to work, but I don't know where to start. That individual completed his acute hospitalization at Abbott Northwestern, did extended rehabilitation at a residence affiliated with Courage Center, and at this point in time, I'm pleased to say that he is back to work half-time with the plan to return to work full-time. The services that we provided for this individual to make it possible for him to return to work included the counseling and guidance, providing, frankly, support that, yes, even though this has happened to you and it's been a life-changing event, you can certainly get back to work. Coordination of return to work with the employer, working directly with the employer to provide the consultation and assistance so that employer was prepared to make the necessary accommodations to be able to provide the work environment that would enable this individual to be successful, given his newfound or given his disability. Also, driver evaluation and assessment, and van modification. You know, obviously this individual, as many do, wanted to be as independent as possible, and so we were able to provide the support so this individual could have the modification to his van so he could, you know, get to and from work. Also provided Dragon Naturally Speaking software training, again, because he was quadriplegic, was no longer able to do keyboarding in the traditional way. There's software available, so the keyboarding is voice activated, so we're able to provide that. And then the worksite support, not only for him as an individual, but also for the employer in making the adjustments that needed to happen in order for this individual to successfully return to work. The change item that you see will be on page 56 of your budget book. As Commissioner McElroy had indicated at the beginning of Dee's presentation, is that the Vocational Rehabilitation Program is a partnership between the federal government, specifically the Department of Education, and the state. And we are required in Minnesota to provide a 21.3% match for the federal funds that we get. In other words, as Commissioner McElroy indicated, for every dollar that the state of Minnesota puts on the table, the federal government puts on the table $3.70. This initiative that you see before you is requesting an increase in our state appropriations, so we are in a position to pull down additional federal monies. The good news in this is that the federal government does in fact have additional funds to make available. However, we will not be able to draw those additional funds down. In this current federal fiscal year 06, we were actually unable, we didn't have sufficient match to draw down $382,000. Were it not for the overlap of the state fiscal year and the federal fiscal year, we would have, based on that shortfall of our state match, would have had to return $1.4 million to the federal government. So it's important, I think, to understand the implications of this budget initiative. If we are able to secure the additional state match, we will be able to draw down anywhere between $11 and $13 million to provide services. If we're unable to secure the necessary match, the impact in terms of the federal dollars that will have to be left on the table will be a minimum of $8.8 million by federal fiscal year 09. So I'm open to any questions that you might have about the budget initiative regarding the Vocational Rehabilitation Program.
Representative Stevenson, did you have a question on that?
Yes, Mr. Chair. Thank you. In relation to your clientele, and about what percentage of your clientele do you receive out of the education system? Typically, right now, for special needs individuals, they are able to stay in the school system until 22. And I'm wondering what kind of percentage of your clientele you're actually seeing come out of the high school system.
Okay. Mr. Chair, Representative, I appreciate your question. As I interpret your question, it's related to transition age youth. And at this point in time, we have 11% of our individuals receiving intensive services from VR are transition age youth. However, I was just meeting with the special education directors yesterday to inform them of our initiative to nearly double the number of transition age youth receiving intensive VR services by 2010. We recognize that the transition age youth are a critical population for us. We need to be able to respond to their needs when they're in school, so as they approach graduation and as they graduate and look for the post-secondary education and so on, that they have the resources necessary so they can be competitively employed. Frankly, if we are not successful with this budget initiative, we will have to pull back on our objectives regarding increasing our outreach to transition age youth, because we will just not have the resources to fund those post-secondary education plans and so on.
Thank you, Ms. Chair. And I think one of the initiatives, this is a great initiative, and I think one of the things that we're talking about in higher education are the special needs, special education children that are coming and actually staying in and past 18 years until 22 years, which puts an additional load on the education funding issue. And if we're able to transition them earlier, I think it saves dollars on that end. And if we can leverage those federal dollars, we can actually come out ahead on the process. So I think it's a great program, and I strongly encourage it.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, Representative Severson. Let me bring back Rick Calgary.
Ms. Peck, before you leave, Ms. Peck, if I'm following your budget here on page 55, the increase that is showing under federal deed for the 08-09 budget is just an increase without the $1.5 million, right?
We're looking for an increase of our state appropriation of $1.5
right.
million per year for the biennium.
If you look there, your federal deed dollars under vocational rehabilitation increased from 38.5 in 07 to 40 and then to 41.5 in 09.
That's just because of an increase on the federal level. Without, it'll be much higher when you get the $1.5 million, right?
Mr. Chair, my understanding is that the public vocational rehabilitation program is a mandatorily funded program, and so the federal government is required to provide a cost of living adjustment for public VR programs. However, if we don't have that 21.3% match, the money can be there, but we can't touch it.
All right.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. And I believe Mr. Caligiuri is going to start on page 57 of your budget book.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I will now go over the youth employment program. We have a Federal Workforce Investment Act youth program that is strictly federal funded. And we also have, there's a state-funded Minnesota Youth Program. Both programs serve youth between the ages of 14 and 21. And in both cases, both programs, they're economically disadvantaged youth, and they prioritize at-risk youth as well. There is also a exclusive to the city of Minneapolis, a Minneapolis Summer Youth Employment Program that just started up last year. And in addition, there is also a federal youth build program, which primarily received federal funding and state funding as well. And that program targets older youth between ages 16 through 24 and engages them in both construction and renovation projects. And again, these are at-risk youth. And there are independent providers of that program located throughout the state. There is one change item or governor's recommendation in the youth area, and that is on page 60, and it's called Minnesota Career Guides. We piloted this program last year in 14 workforce service areas throughout the state, and basically this initiative would provide funding to hire approximately 150 college students to serve as interns. And they would go through training relative to the partners involved, which would be post-secondary education institutions, as well as our staff, our labor market analysts. And they would be working primarily in the high schools with counselors and providing career counseling and career exploration activities with high school students. And they do things like site visits to businesses, workforce centers, and post-secondary education institutions as well. Again, we piloted this last year in about 14 areas. It was very, very successful. And in the year prior to that, we piloted it in St. Cloud as well. Again, very successful. The governor's recommendation is $500,000 per year for the biennium for this initiative.
Mr. Caligiuri, does this leverage any other federal money or...
Mr. Chair, no, it doesn't.
Or could it?
No, it doesn't.
Ms. Pott, Representative Pott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I want to be intrigued by this proposal. I'm hoping not to be troubled by it, I guess, working as a college counselor myself and having a master's degree and doing career planning with students and knowing the level of education I have. I guess I'm a little wondering about really what expectations do you have for the college students? At what level are they at? That's my initial question, is at what level are they at?
Mr. Chair, Representative, again, this is this initiative is in partnership with the Department of Education and local school districts as well. The students are interns, and they do receive credit for this. And they're primarily individuals who are going into education or counseling. And this is very well received in the part of K through 12 because, as you well know, the counselor to student ratio in high schools is pretty abysmally low, and they have welcomed the assistance here and in the training that's involved with these individuals. And again, it's primarily to give them access to resources. It's as far as the true counseling. Again, these These folks are not registered or certified counselors, but they do try to educate and enlighten students as to what resources are available. And again, they do a lot of things like site visits.
Just to follow up, thank you, Mr. Chair. And you're right. The counselor to student ratio is abysmally low. It's the lowest in the 50 states, I believe, in the state of Minnesota. And I do believe we need more counselors in the K-12 system as well as in higher ed. And we should be, I think if you could devote dollars to that, this isn't your responsibility, but in the education department, devote some dollars to that. I think you would help the process along the way. Again, these students that you're talking about, though, are they then graduate level students? And so then they're interning, this is a part of their graduate level experience?
Mr. Representative,
that one. Mr. Chairman, Representative Poppe. Although some may be graduate students, they were described principally to us as juniors and seniors in college. And one of the reasons for the great interest by the institutions is to increase the number of students who may take an interest in counseling and continue on to complete their undergraduate and perhaps graduate degrees because of the concern you expressed that we're going to need more counselors in the future. And if you would like to talk to someone who's involved with the program, we can arrange for that from the Department of Education. But our role has been the connecting role and to make sure that it happens on a statewide basis.
Yes, thank you, actually. Commissioner, I think I would appreciate that communication.
Someone behind me is writing feverishly to make this happen, and I suspect it's Ms. Batsley. make sure that we make that connection and that someone contacts you. And you may be able to give us advice that helps improve the program.
Thank you.
We appreciate that.
Well, Commissioner, I hope I see one of their initiatives is to help them with post-secondary admissions requirements and financial aid. And that's certainly with what we've heard in this committee from college students all over the state, it's something they could maybe use some help with. Representative Moe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm looking at page 59 and 58, 59. And you spoke to youth build. First off, I guess, and I'd like to just first let you know how important that program is for literally hundreds of kids who, for whatever other reason, haven't been able to get through high school before they entered that program. They obtained GEDs and learned to trade, and it's very successful. Looking at your budget, I'm not able to really understand where the governor is proposing that funding come from. I'm hoping it's not in the one-time appropriation, leaving that program again vulnerable in 2 years. Maybe you could help me to, again, you know, I'm a physical education teacher, not an accountant, so you might have to speak slowly.
Mr. Chair, Representative Moe, The governor's recommendation going forward is, I believe in the last appropriation, it was a little over $750,000, and the language in that appropriation said of that amount, $75,000 are tails going forward. And so the governor's budget does reflect the $75,000 going forward in tails.
There's $150,000 for the biennium in the base as a pass-through to youth build of state funds, and then there's some additional federal youth build funds that I think are also
correct
on the federal base.
And Mr. Chair, just Bob, so then based on the previous funding levels, this is stable?
Mr. Chair, Representative Moe, no, it's some of that was one-time funding.
Mm-hmm. Well, Representative Moe and maybe Mr. Caligiuri or Commissioner, the ongoing money, I'm assuming, there in the middle of page 59 is for the Minneapolis Youth Program, right, the 1.250 and 1.250?
Mr. Chair, that's correct.
And then do all of the other youth workforce programs, they drop off this year, don't they, in the governor's budget? That was general fund money?
Mr. Chair, the youth build fund, state funding was general fund funding. It's up at the top of page 59. And again, approximately 100,000 of that was one time, and 75,000 was intended to be tails.
Okay. Maybe Representative Gunther can help me. Didn't you salvage this with Representative Gunther with taking money from the Workforce Development Fund?
There's a workforce.
Mr. Chairman, that's correct.
And so,
Representative Park was very focused on getting that program funded, and
so the 10.9 million then is gone and done, and the program's basically done. Other than what the federal money is there, So, a very good program is dropping off, and it concerns me, and I'm sure it concerns you, Representative Moe, because you know, and I'm sure it concerns Representative Gunther. But
Mr. Chair, I would hope that we in this committee will not have that happen. One-time money for this program, which is really fundamentally important to many youth in our communities, the chance that they needed in order to make something of their lives. I would assume that we would support that.
Well, the only place to find it, Representative Moe, would seem to be, you know, to do within the one-time money for other programs that are being proposed, and a lot of them are good programs, or to take it from the Workforce Development Fund again. Well, Representative Murphy, last question. We'll get out of here. I see the other committees coming in.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Commissioner, could you have someone contact me, too, please, about the Workforce Development Minnesota Youth Career Guide? Maybe Representative Poppy and I can meet that person together even. When I spoke with the governor, it seemed to me that he was pretty adamant that this would not be counseling. This would be job coaching kind of thing. Younger people than counselors are. But in the dialogue that's written here, it says that they will work with local guidance counselors. And in some cases, there aren't any local guidance counselors because they've been eliminated from the school job force. And so now I'm confused because you said it would be maybe a step to becoming counselors. And I think we need that clarification of what career guides are, what job coaches are, what counselors are.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Murphy, we'll get that information. Our belief is that it is career-oriented, but that they would be working in guidance counseling departments. We'll have someone from the Department of Education and from our staff replicate us all.
Thank you, Commissioner.
Representative Poppy, because she's going to be my job coach on this case.
We'll get out of here as soon as Representative Detmer approves the minutes of Tuesday, February 27th, and he moves them.
Mr. Chairman, I move.
Members, are there any additions or corrections? If not, all those in favor, signify by saying aye. Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. We'll see you tomorrow because we never got through the biggest chunk of your budget yet, which is unemployment division, unemployment insurance. So we'll see you tomorrow. And